Christmas Eve. Doug checked his wristwatch against the digital wall clock as he paced the empty lounge of the rocket port. "It's going to be close," he said to himself. "Razor close." As he waited impatiently, he thought back to the days when he'd sneak out to the old rocket port just to watch the lunar transfer vehicles land or take off. It was not even 8 years ago, but it seemed lost back in the hazy mists of ancient history. Now he watched the wall-sized screen in the underground lounge of the rocket port as the LTV carrying his mother gracefully descended on invisible jets of rocket exhaust, kicking up a small storm of dust and pebbles around the concrete landing pad. The big, ungainly spacecraft settled slowly on its strut-thin legs. With its bulbous plastiglass pods for the crew and passengers, it looked to Doug like a giant metallic insect squatting on the lunar surface. "Okay, they're down. Now get the access tube connected. We don't have a minute to spare." The newly decorated lounge was empty except for him. His mother and the medical team were the only passengers on this LTV, except for the body of Lev Brudnoy. Doug had expected his life to simplify once the war was over, but it had become more hectic. While Joanna and Seigo Yamagata personally negotiated a merger between Masterson Aerospace Corporation and Yamagata Industries Limited, Doug was drawn into the whirl of establishing a government for the independent moonbase and handling the delicate personnel problems of men and women who wanted to remain on the moon without giving up their Earthside citizenships. Tomorrow, Toshiro Takai was scheduled to arrive from Nippon One, his first visit to moonbase in the flesh after years of virtual reality contacts. Doug was going to broach the extremely sensitive subject of inviting Nippon One to join moonbase and declare its independence from Japan. He doubted that Takai would be able to carry that off, but he knew his VR friend would feel slighted if he didn't at least ask. And there was so much to do before Takai arrived. Again, Doug looked at the wall clock. Its digital numbers seemed to be leaping ahead. At last, one of the port technicians entered the lounge, ambling too slowly to please Doug, and tapped at the wall pad by the access tunnel hatch. The gleaming metal door popped open a few centimeters, with a sigh of air blowing in from the slightly overpressurized tunnel. Feeling nervous, anxious, Doug watched as the LTV's two pilots pushed the hatch fully open from the other side. The medical team was right behind them. Four doctors, two men and two women. They looked self-assured, competent in their Earthside business clothes as the port technician led to them the tractor that was waiting to whisk them to the infirmary. At last Joanna stepped through, looking years older than the last time Doug had seen her, but still regally splendid in a yuletide green dress that glittered in the light from the ceiling panels. "Welcome to Moonbase," Doug said ritually, then embraced his mother. She was tired, he could see. Dark rings circled her eyes. But he urged her, "Come on, we don't have a minute to lose."
"My things? The ground crew will take care of them. I briefed them myself. They know what to do."
She nodded, just a trifle hesitant, but let Doug take her by the wrist and lead her out to the tunnel that ran back to the main section of the base. He helped her up into the old standby tractor, then climbed into the driver's seat and started its electric motors.
"I hope we're not too late," Joanna said.
"We're shaving it close." As they drove through the long, straight, featureless tunnel, the wide-spaced overhead lights casting shadows across their faces like the phases of the moon, Joanna told her son about the negotiations with Yamagata. "We've got to be able to continue manufacturing clipper ships," Doug said. "That's the important thing. That's Moonbase's economic lifeblood."
"Sago's agreed to that," Joanna said. "He's all in favor of it, now that Foray's stepping down from the UN. We're even talking about manufacturing automobiles."
"With nanomachines?"
"In Japan."
"Wow. Things really have changed."
"In fact," Joanna continued, "it turns out that one of the major reasons why he wanted control of Moonbase was your nanotechnology capability."
Doug shot her a puzzled frown. "But I thought..." Joanna silenced him with an upraised hand.
"Sago has a genetic predisposition to cancer. He wants to be able to come up here and have nanotherapy to remove any tumors he may develop."
"That's why he wanted Moonbase?"
She nodded. "That's his real reason. He was willing to go along with Foray to gain control of Moonbase as long as he could have nanotherapy in secret." and he killed Zimmerman in the process. Chris Cardenas is still here. Anger simmering in his guts, Doug grumbled. Why should we let Chris help him? He killed Zimmerman. He might even have been involved in Lev's murder. Joanna seemed strangely unperturbed. Don't leap to conclusions, Doug. Sago's not the devil incarnate. Have some Christmas charity. He stared at her as the lights flashed by. What's going on between you two?
Nothing, she said quickly.
Except, I think we've learned to respect each other. And he had nothing to do with Lev's death. That was strictly the new morality's doing.
You're sure?
My security people found that the corporation is honeycombed with new morality zealots. That's why I've decided to live up here permanently.
Can't you do anything about them? Back Earthside, I mean.
Joanna said matter-of-factly, there are too many of them, Doug. As long as we can operate here on the moon and use nanotechnology, let them stew in their own juices for a generation or two. They'll get what they deserve.
You sound like Ginny Anson, he said. If she had her way, we wouldn't have any contact with Earth at all.
That wouldn't be so bad at that.
Doug suddenly saw the full Earth in his mind's eye, hanging in the dark lunar sky, shining bright and beautiful. We can't let them strangle themselves, he murmured.
Doug, there's more than 10 billion people on Earth, Joanna said.
We can't save them. Yes, we can, he insisted. We can try, at least. She shook her head.
I thought you wanted to look outward and push the frontier.
That's the best way to help them. Create new knowledge, new wealth. Keep the safety valve open for anyone who wants to use it. Joanna took a deep breath.
You almost sound religious.
He broke into a grin. Well, it is Christmas, almost. She had no reply, and they rode to the end of the tunnel in silence. As they got down from the tractor, Doug said, I hope the medical team got there in time. He had to slow his pace to accommodate his mother, a little wobbly in the low gravity despite the weighted boots she wore. As they approached the infirmary, Doug saw that a small crowd had gathered outside. Anson, Falcone, even Zoltan Kadar was out there waiting. Doug pushed through them and into the infirmary's observation room, Joanna right behind him. Nick O'Malley was just stepping through the door from inside the infirmary, stripping off a surgical mask. His face was sweaty, pale. I hope I never have to go through that again, he said, his voice shaking. Chris Cardenas and her husband Pete, the neurosurgeon, came out right behind O'Malley.
Your Earthside team was too late, Chris said, smiling broadly.
As O'Malley sank into one of the chairs along the far wall, Pete Cardenas announced, It's a 6-pound, 5-ounce baby girl.
Mother and daughter are both fine, Chris added. Natural childbirth without the obstetrics team you brought in from Earthside.
The first baby born on the moon, Joanna said, sitting in the chair next to O'Malley.
Congratulations, Daddy,
Chris said to him. Doug held out his hand and O'Malley took it in a limp, weary grip. Never again, he muttered.
Look.
Turning to the observation window, Doug saw Edith holding a conglomeration of blankets in her arms with a tiny red squirming bald baby in the middle of it.
I got the whole thing on camera, Edith said through the window. She'll be on global news in a few hours.
O'Malley brightened a bit and pushed himself to his feet.
She's kind of beautiful, isn't she?
Even in the midst of life, we are in the midst of death. Intoned Robert Wixon. Doug had been surprised when Wix had volunteered to preside at Lev Brudnoy's burial service. The physicist was also a lay minister, he had revealed. Now they put Lev's remains into the soil of the farm he had lovingly tended over the years. Ashes to ashes, Wixon murmured, dust to dust. Doug stood at his mother's side. Joanna sobbed quietly, as Lev was lowered into the ground where he had planted the moon's first flowers. Hours later, after dinner, Edith and Doug joined practically everyone else in Moonbase in decorating the 3-meter-tall aluminum tree that had been erected in the middle of the cave. There was plenty of rocket juice going around, and God knows what else. The party went from festive to raucous as the hours wore on. Long after midnight, Doug walked beside Edith as they headed for their